The race is on, or certainly it is when it comes to deciding exactly what to do about Formula One's new rules amid the current COVID-19 pandemic, which is putting tremendous financial stress upon the teams and Formula One as a whole. Now, what we've got here today is something a little bit different. This is a crossover episode with one of our other six podcasts produced by The Race, the Gary Anderson F1 Show. In this episode, me and Gary talk about the wider picture and the debates that are going on between the teams about what to do. This obviously is available in our Gary Anderson F1 Show feed, but it's ideal for the Race F1 podcast as well. So have a listen to it here. If you enjoy it, do remember, subscribe to the Gary Anderson F1 Show as well for your weekly dose of Gary alongside the Race F1 podcast. Away we go. Formula One was quick to take action to confront the financial problems that faced it amid the COVID-19 pandemic, but further moves are proving to be a little more of a sticking point as the various stakeholders reach something of an impasse in a dispute about reducing the budget cap and potentially deferring the new regulations another 12 months to 2023, as well as the mechanisms for restricting development. I'm your host, Ed Straw, and who better to untangle this situation than a man who's probably spent more hours of his life than he cares to remember in these sorts of meetings, Gary Anderson. So Gary, just to start off in general terms before we really get into detail, what's it actually like to be on the insides of these sorts of technical meetings?
Well, you know, everybody has their own vested interests. They're always looking after themselves, to be honest. Very seldom do they work together as a group. And I've been very impressed so far as to what we've seen really with stuff as far as the teams getting together and doing stuff and making decisions and backing it up. But obviously these bits and pieces now are becoming the big sticking blocks, which is really the budget cap is one, and the development direction you take within that budget cap, because it all has to unfold. Formula One's in a sort of very strange little place, because you know the teams get paid for their last sort of 2 years' performance, so it takes a while to catch up with itself. So it's not as though, you know, whenever they stop racing, suddenly there's no checks coming in the door. The prize money should come in the door for the previous years. So it's a little while down the road before it really will hurt them financially. So they've got to try and manage that now. They've got to try to plan for that now. And that's what they're really trying to do, I suppose. And, you know, the big problem with us all is we have well-financed top-end teams, manufacturer-backed. We have others that are doing it more or less the way we used to do it with Jordan. You know, they're there for the sport. It's a business for them, for sure, and everybody's making a little bit of money out of it. That's what a business is all about. But it's still just a business for them, and, you know, they need to make the ends meet more importantly and more consistently than the big manufacturers.
Yeah, it's certainly complicated to try and reconcile big and small teams. That's been a battle for Formula One for a long time. Well, I guess the sort of best place to start, all these things are interconnected, so we will jump around a bit, but the budget cap overall, now this was part of the original 2021 regs. When they put back the 2021 regs, they said the budget cap would come in. The figure for the budget cap is $175 million, and there are various exemptions, drivers, and all sorts of little details in the new financial regs. Now, there seems to be a broad kind of agreement about reducing the budget cap by a certain amount, but the big teams don't seem to want to go lower than $150 million. You know, Zak Brown said that McLaren's proposed as low as $100 million. Now, intuitively, getting it as low as possible seems sensible, but it's a bit more complicated than that, and Ferrari is particularly strong on this topic. So how do you see their position on this?
Well, if I was looking at the budget cap, I would be going the opposite direction. And I'd be taking away all those little scenarios that you talk about, the driver's salaries, the management salaries, the commercial side, and I'd be lumping in as one. And probably either staying at $175 million or going even a little bit higher. Because it's the big boys with the big money that pay the big drivers. So, you know, let's say Lewis Hamilton does earn $50 million a year. But, you know, I don't know what Lando Norris earns or Carlos Sainz earns at McLaren, for example, but it ain't $50 million for sure. So you then get your decision of spending your budget or your budget cap on what you want to, either the car or the driver. But if you take away, I suppose, Mercedes's driver budget, their management budget, their commercial budget and all that stuff, you'd probably say that if you allowed the budget cap to be $200 million, and you take away the same thing for what McLaren spend on it, and I'm using McLaren as an example here, what McLaren spend on their drivers, et cetera, you'd probably end up with $100 million that's spent on the car in both scenarios. So going along and trying to knock the budget back down only means that the top drivers become more important to the equation of winning. They always will be important to the equation of winning, but at least if it's part of that budget cap, you've got to take them into account. Can you make your car go better and have a cheaper driver, or do you need that top-line driver in the car? So that's a decision you have to make within the team. At the moment, it doesn't matter. If you go down to $100 million for the budget cap, everybody has the same, and then it's the guys that have got 200 or 250 million that will just pay the best drivers. And, you know, looking into the future a little bit, you'd probably say there'd be an unlimited offer for somebody like Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc by the team that could afford them. So suddenly, you know, you've got this domination again, immediately starting. So that's not where we want to get to. And I think also it would mean it would open doors for good new drivers coming in, because they wouldn't be looking for that sort of money. The George Russells, they would get opportunities, for example, to try to get on in a bigger team quite quickly, because the team would realise that spending the money on the car would be just as important as spending the money on the driver.
And of course, a lot of these exemptions have been quite long fought over for some time, so I doubt they're that keen on rolling back. And obviously the drivers, as you say, exempt. That's the highest three paid employees are exempt as well. I wonder why all the team bosses voted for that, given that they'd have been often the highest paid ones.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly what I'm saying, to be honest. It is that sort of scenario that we've got ourselves sort of caught up in. And I think it has to be looked at as a complete package, because otherwise it will be, them and us, even more of them and us. You know, the big boys that earn the big money. You know, if you were to go out tomorrow and sign up, I don't know who it would be, but, you know, the best three top-end team management, technical director, and whatever else basically that makes the team up, and the two best drivers, and then you had the same money left as a McLaren or someone to go racing with them, you're going to get beaten, you know, because that's the way life is. So it's very difficult for them to step back and look at things in a different direction, but this is now a time to step back and look at things in a different direction. This is not coming around. This is not something that's going to go away in a couple of weeks, and this is something that nobody's ever experienced before. You know, so you need to look at things in a different direction. You can't just keep your head in the sand, following the path that you set out, a few months ago before this thing popped up, really. I mean, last year, nobody knew anything about this. Come December, it was happening in China. Now it's worldwide, and it's quite dramatic still.
Yeah, certainly a very serious situation, which is why this action has been considered. Looking at the kind of sticking points specifically on the budget cap, obviously, Ferrari's position is that because they design and produce and research parts that are then sold to other teams, Haas and Alfa Romeo are their kind of technical partners, their customers, effectively. They argue that they've therefore got higher costs that have to be spent on this kind of thing. So they're suggesting maybe you have a cap, and then you have there's a mechanism referred to in the financial regs, but it's not specified. They want a really structured information on that, so they know how much they can spend on that. They're also apparently concerned about a scenario where they'd have to be forced into making redundancies, because of course, if you put a lower outright number, staff costs are a big thing. Staff costs in terms of paying redundancies are exempted from the cost cap as well. So I think this is an important point. F1 can't get into a position where it's forcing teams to lay off people it wouldn't have to because of this, because that's then harming sort of real people with, you know, mortgages, families, and that would be a wrong situation, wouldn't it?
Well, that's the last thing you want to see happening, for sure, is people suffering the consequences. But I think with my solution, you get less opportunity of that, because you do have a higher budget, and you just have to make your decisions about whether you pursue making your car better and using your budget to its maximum, or you say, okay, you know, I'll just put something together with a few nuts and bolts, and we'll stick in the best driver in, and he'll go and win. We know that doesn't happen. You know, that really does not happen. The best driver can go to a bad team, and he will not win races. He'll be more, probably make it more competitive, but he won't go out and win races. So, Ferrari's argument, I think, is a bit weak, because you know they build road cars, and they sell them, and they make money. So they know what the commercial world is like as far as manufacturing something and selling it. You have X amount of development costs for, let's take a gearbox, for example. Let's say that there's design time, the research time, all that stuff to do a brand new gearbox is going to cost you $10 million. This is a round as a figure. Say it's $10 million. That's okay. They are then building for their team for the season, let's say 10 of them, just because it's a nice round figure again. So they've got $10 million spent on it. The gearbox himself probably cost, you know, $100,000 or something to build a gearbox. So you've got another $1 million there. And so that's that. Your cost for 10 gearboxes has become $11 million. If you built another 10 gearboxes for Haas or for whoever else buys your gearbox, there is a commercial cost for that. So in reality, you know, the 10 gearboxes for Haas would also cost $100,000 each, which they would get from Haas. Now, they either decide, okay, we'll supply them at $100,000 each, or we'll take our $11 million and we'll divide it by 20 gearboxes. There is a number you can come up with that means that commercially you can use your expertise, your manpower, etc., to come up with the best piece of kit in the world and actually make it cheaper for yourself because you're selling it to other people. Whether you just add on a percentage profit or whether you add on, you know, the complete development cost, it doesn't matter. For both teams, that product will end up being a cheaper product once pulled it onto the car. So it's just commercial business. If you make a washing machine, you know, it takes X amount of research, costs you X amount of money, you need your business plan needs to say, I'm going to sell X of these before I make any money on it. So all the components in the car are just like that, basically. And they just need to be managed and managed correctly. Maybe Formula One people aren't too good at doing that, but it needs to be managed on a commercial basis.
Yeah, and of course, those contracts will have been structured in the correct way. There seems to be a fear from the big teams that if they go below 150 million without a very clear structure for these supply things, that actually they concern the smaller teams will gain a competitive advantage over them. Now, while I can see the basic logic of that argument, it does seem maybe overstated because they're still going to be the bigger teams with the bigger resource, aren't they? Because we know not all teams are going to be operating on the budget cap. The lower the budget cap goes, the more will be. But, you know, it's not like the budget cap in its original form of $175 million, everyone would have that as their budget for the year.
No, and far from it, to be honest. But, oh dear, wouldn't it be really sad to see the small teams get one over the big boys? You know, as I say, in these meetings, the one thing that stands out to you, everybody looks after their own vested interests. And of course, that is what the teams are going to say. But at the end of the day, the competition is such that the small teams are getting left behind. So there has to be a little bit of an incentive for the small teams to be able to do a better job. The big teams spend money because, it's wrong to say this, but they have, you know, more manpower. They have higher paid personnel. They have more stability because those higher paid personnel are happy where they are. They can afford the best drivers. They can afford the luxury of putting more new bits on the car all the time, more development. But just even changing a part from, you know, an upright assembly or something that's getting a bit long in the tooth to a fresh one, all that stuff can happen. So the reliability issues potentially reduce dramatically. So that's all you're trying to do is bring it a little bit closer together, bring it to a number that sort of justifies its existence, I suppose you might call it, especially in this situation that we're in now, and make the teams all try and pull them back to a level playing field. So I think there's a commercial interest from everything. Mercedes don't spend that sort of money on their team because they're not getting the coverage. Now, if they were running around, you know, first and second, they actually get less coverage than if they're battling for fourth and fifth. So they've got to, you know, they haven't seen that battle for fourth and fifth and the TV coverage that they would get for it. They've only just done their first, you know, run around first and second. And to be honest, you know, the seconds on TV that Lewis Hamilton and his Mercedes would have got last year is probably a lot less than some other team, as I say, in the top of the midfield. So that's what it's all about. It's about TV time. And this could work towards that as well, because if it's more competitive, you'll get more TV time.
Where do you think this budget cap debate will end up? It seems like that there's a desire for almost a kind of two-tier thing whereby the bigger teams that are supplying smaller teams can operate at a slightly higher budget to reflect the investment they're spending. And with the new rules, which we'll talk a little bit about later, obviously there will be, it's not like they can just keep pumping out exactly the same things, because there will be changes. So do you think that's kind of an outcome that will eventually be agreed on?
Well, it's a difficult one because you've got two scenarios. I mean, if you look at the Haas and the Ferrari, you'll see a family resemblance through the car. I'm not saying by any means that Haas have copied Ferrari, but you'll see a family resemblance. If you look at the Alfa Romeo and the Ferrari, you won't see a family resemblance. So where does that what does that mean, that you're using somebody else's concept idea and time and research to sort of develop your car? And again, a very good example of that is the pink Mercedes, as it's called. You know, that is, without doubt, if you look at it, a clone of the 2019 Mercedes. So you've got this situation where does that become thought about in budget cap? The fact that you can look at other cars and come up with something somehow or another. I'm not quite sure how you do it all from pictures completely. I'm not quite sure how your research doesn't change. And even just your own ego mean you change some of the lines somewhere just to make it look a little bit different. I mean, you know, the one thing that stood out in the pink Mercedes is the nose shape. It's identical. There is no need for that to be identical. I mean, the shape that Mercedes came up with there, for sure, yes, it's obviously worked. But you would put a bigger fillet radius on it, or make it a little bit narrower here, or a little bit wider there, or something, just to put your own stamp on it. And they didn't. So that's an area where the budget caps will never, ever accommodate that. So somewhere along the line, it needs to be sorted out. But it's almost impossible to control that part, because we all walk down the pit lane, we all look at stuff, get thousands of pictures taken, and you end up with what you end up with. So something black and white has to be there, I think. And to me, that if you move the budget cap in the bigger direction and include everything in it, you might just get a chance of capturing that sort of area for doing things differently.
Well, let's move on to development control. We know the cars will be carried over to 2021. There's going to be certain parts of the package will be frozen, and they want to allow some development. So it seems there's a broad consensus on having a token system. So you get a set number of tokens, and then presumably the system will be that changing X will cost you however many tokens. We had a system like this for the power units originally under these regulations, which proved unpopular and was dropped in the end. Do you think this is a sensible way to control it? Because I guess you've then got a two-tier thing where some things are locked and then there's other things that you can change, but within the things you can change, there's controls by having the tokens.
The tokens will always be a mechanism for controlling that, but how do you manage it is the big question. Now, I've thought about it long and hard, and the FIA, F1 itself, and all of the teams now do a lot of research, aerodynamic research, CFD research, and wind tunnel research, especially whenever they're trying to understand the current car and moving forward to what was the 2021 car, which is now the 2022 car. So basically, it's a very good understanding of the areas that produce the downforce on the car. The downforce produced in an X specification is, you know, there's 100% of the car. So, for example, the barge boards, let's say, produce 20%. The diffuser produces 25%, the rear wing produces 35%, and so on and so forth, through all those main big components that are downforce-producing devices. So you just say, okay, for each car, aerodynamically, you're going to have 100 tokens. And if you change the barge boards, you pay 25 for them, because that's 25% of the downforce that car produces, or the underfloor X, you know, whatever the numbers are. So you just have your percentage of downforce produced by the car for the components, and you can separate that quite well and individually, and it's all done. It's all there. So that would give you a good aerodynamic control over that sort of area. And you divide it into the big bits, and you probably produce some boxes to say, this is what we call the barge boards. It takes into account the leading edge of the side pod or whatever, a box there that says X from the center of the car outward, height, and starts at the reference plane. And the same for the diffuser, you give it a box shape, and then you change into the inside of that box, cost you X amount of tokens. The big problem falling into that is that obviously each team will have 5, 6, 7, 8 different rear wing specifications for different tracks. So if you take Monaco to Monza, it's a very different rear wing. So you've either got to come up with something for a specific wing change that you can do. You allow that to be a wild card where you can change the size of the wing, or you look at the frontal area of the rear wing, for example, and you say that's it's 80% of the 100% that you can use. So Monaco, like, would use 100% of the frontal area of the wing to produce downforce. And if you say your Monza spec is 30% of that, then you only pay 30% of the tokens for that component or something. So there's a mechanism there for aerodynamic development that would control it quite well. and allow the tokens to work. I don't know why they just don't say you're allowed to change these bits, you know, once a year or something like that, because there's X amount of bits you could go around the car and say these are the important factors. Then you get into the mechanical side. You have to allow, within all of that, you have to allow stuff to be made more reliable. So that has to be a bit of an open door. If you've got a problem with the front wheel bearing, for example, and you may have to, you know, change your specification of the bearing and maybe make the upright with a bigger hole in it or a slightly bigger axle or something stupid like that, you know, you have to be allowed to be able to do that. But I think you have to have the failure first. You know, you have to actually define that this has failed. This is the failure. This is our reactive direction to fix it. So I think there's a mechanism there to do the tokens and to do it quite comprehensively. And aerodynamic development is the direction the car needs to go faster, basically. Everything else is pretty much a token gesture towards looking after the tires better. So you could do it with the tokens. As I say, CFD will dictate what each part of the car's value is, and then go from there.
Yeah, I think the agreement on restricting the development makes sense, because you want to keep the cost down for the kind of next 18 months. Obviously, they've frozen wind tunnel and aero work on the new rules. They can't do that for the rest of the year. It's early next year. It comes back in. So that's sensible, because obviously these are long-term impacts as well. It's not going to be it takes a couple of months for everything to be balanced up. The whole income for next year is going to be badly hit by this, because fewer races. I think the races are about a third, just under a third of F1's overall revenue, and obviously the F1 teams divide up at a share of that. So, I mean, you have talked in the past, you referred to it there, about having sort of homologation phases, so you could have five races, whatever, with certain packages, etc. So there could be simpler ways of doing this, because the one thing that is concerning is obviously if you then hit a specific reliability problem or something that's hugely expensive on the tokens to fix, when it is just a very esoteric problem that may have struck someone. I mean, teams don't have these problems as much as they used to because of the amount of work they can and R&D they can put into it. But it's these exceptional circumstances that sometimes rules like this make difficult, isn't it?
It is, yeah, the exceptional circumstances. Now, there has to be a window left open, I think, to fix that. Now, if they had something where basically if a problem crops up, and it could be just an aerodynamic problem or a handling problem, it could be something that pops up there, and they say, look, we've got this problem. They define it well enough, applying to the FIA and F1 as it is now, because the two of them are sort of fairly equal in all of this stuff, and say, we need to try to fix this because, you know, we want to go racing better. And they put forward their proposal. And that proposal then is put to the teams and said, look, is this acceptable? You know, let's take the front wheel bearing failure, for example, as a mechanical thing. You know, there's no team going to stand in the way of Williams putting a new front upright in the car because, you know, to let them make the end of a race. That's not going to happen. And even at that point in time, you'd say, you know, let's say a 70% vote or something would get it through. So there might be the team that's battling with Williams stole a little bit on it, to be honest. But most of this stuff goes around, it comes around and bites you sometime or another. So it'd be far better to be open and allow it to happen, especially with these circumstances. So you could have an open house for any criteria that popped up that was ruining a team's potential, and just make it a 70% vote by the teams, the FIA and F and FOM or Formula One, and you have, you know, you get out of those situations, and that'd be the thing about having all the teams working together, or all the people working together that are involved in making Formula One happen, because that's what has to happen right now. Or, you know, we could see Formula One disappear. It could happen. It could just step itself back by 30, 40 years very, very quickly, which might not be a bad thing, because it might mean there's a room for Cosworth to bring up an old DFV, dust it down and stick it in the back of a car, and suddenly you have racing again. This is going to be the thing. When does racing, forget Formula One or Formula E or Formula 2 or MotoGP, any of that, when does racing actually kick off again? When does it get started? And this is what you're looking at, the interests of getting racing back up and running again in one way or another. It doesn't have to be the way it was, and it never will be the way it was. It will be different, and they've got to accept that. So there will be some areas need to be left open-handed to make sure, or open-ended, to make sure that you've got ways out of them if you do, and these restrictions.
I think that's the thing, and one of the reasons Ferrari on the budget cap thing, on the cost cap thing, is particularly keen to get things set, because they see this as a longer term thing, and they want to make sure that if you do implement emergency measures, which these are, that are going to be carried over and have a long term impact, you want to get them right. And to be fair, they've got a little bit of time. They made the first move, so I don't think this is a question of any particular teams being massively problematic. I'd rather they took a few more weeks to set it, because it's not going to make any difference, and get it right than panic it through. Let's look at the kind of almost the broadest of these things, which is the question about deferring the regulations to 2023. So this will be another 12-month delay on the much vaunted new regs originally for 2021. Red Bull, I think, proposed this. Now, interestingly, it felt like this was going to be something that had broad agreement, but F1 and the FIA have kind of blocked this effectively. I guess from F1's perspective, and FIA to a lesser extent, they've both been heavily involved in it, but F1, Liberty commercially, obviously see this as the big point where they can really start boosting the profits of Formula One, because even though Formula One's revenue, like last year, was over $2 billion, its profit was actually, by those standards, razor thin. I think it was less than 1% of that revenue was profit. So should we be surprised by this, or do you think this is something that the bigger picture needs to be looked at to protect the teams and put it back 12 months?
I think it needs to be looked at, yes. I don't think there's any one individual team involved in Formula One that really are 100% behind the regulations. And obviously, Formula One and the FIA are 100% behind the regulations, the change of regulations. So that will always be a sticking block. These regulations were to an extent, or this regulation change was to an extent pushed through by FOM, or by Formula One and the FIA. So it was a sort of fait accompli, and the teams had to buy into it in a way, because, as you say, this was Liberty's big save the world situation. The save the world situation is a completely different deal right now. So I think moving the regulations back to 2023 would be the right thing, because although teams are hurting right now for finance because of sponsorship and all that sort of stuff, teams will hurt more next year because of it. You know, if this racing doesn't continue, and obviously we just had the Canadian Grand Prix cancelled, so the season's getting, or the year that we might end up racing, is getting shorter and shorter. And we talk about this, you know, super season where the two of them go together and whatever ends up being at the end of the day, if and when we get racing again. So the hit's not going to be right now. You know, the hit is going to be later on in this window of change. And the last thing you need to do is go into 2021, as it will be, racing your car, saving, you know, I don't know, on development. If you limit it, control it very, very well, you might save a team $5 million or something for parts over the 2021 season, but you're going to also spend another $25 or $30 million on the development of the 2022 car. You got to move that down the road a little bit further, I believe, to allow the thing to sort of sort itself all out and see where it really is and see what it can afford. Because right now at the minute, if you're making decisions on the income that Formula One will have in 2020, the rest of 2020 and 2021, you know, whatever your potential, whatever you predict, then I think you can half it easily and you still come out with less than that coming in. So this is a bigger hit than I think the big boys sort of think. And if they don't react to it right now, it'll be, you know, the 2021, 2022 where it really does start to hurt.
Of course, some of the big teams, certainly Ferrari, argue that the deferring the regs isn't necessarily a good idea because the new regs, the cars will be cheaper to run. But of course, when it comes to that, that means in the long term you might make a saving, but it's not going to be kind of within 6 months of running them, you've pulled back all that development cost, is it? So, and there's the other dimension as well, which is the even bigger picture, which is, still, we don't have a commercial agreement. There's kind of intention to sort of have a proper Concorde agreement again next year with all teams signed up to it, whereas in recent years it's been governed by a series of bilateral agreements between F1 and the teams, and the FIA have one with Liberty as well. So this is complicated as well. You can maybe understand why F1 and FIA, F1 in particular, don't want to necessarily give up that rules deferment chip while there's other stuff going on. And obviously Liberty are trying to make provisions for granting credit to teams for next year of those who are struggling. So there's all these financial things that are linked into it, because they're going to have to get everyone signed up for next year eventually that they can wait a little bit. But you know, if there's no racing in October, they can't just keep waiting because they need people signed up, don't they? So there's a wider picture here beyond technical, isn't there?
There's a wider picture than beyond technical, and I mean the way it used to work really when Bernie owned or ran Formula One. You know, if you were in a bit of a financial problem, give Bernie a ring and, you know, something would happen. But at the minute, you can't do that. I don't think you can do that. It's you know, they have to have a board meeting. They have to have, you know, 20 people in there voting on it. Can we give these guys, you know, 2 million to tide them over to next month or whatever it be? So it's a very, very difficult scenario that Liberty have got themselves into or bought themselves into, I suppose. You know, they bought this package of Formula One for one simple reason, to make money. That's all it's about. It's just simply that. And at the minute, you know, they are not making money on it. So they are actually hemorrhaging probably dramatically right now, more than anybody else, because all those races that are getting cancelled and stuff, you know, there's payback for that, all that stuff. So it's hemorrhaging on that side, and it's hemorrhaging as far as the teams are concerned. You know, a lot of teams are furloughing their staff, you know, letting them go temporarily at least. So it's one of those sort of situations where change will always cost money. And if no matter whether it makes the cars better or worse or whatever, you know, the change and the regulations will always cost a huge, huge amounts of money. And that's the thing that's hemorrhaging at the moment. It's money that's hemorrhaging. It's not ideas or patterns, thoughts, potential, racing. Nothing of that's hemorrhaging. So I think the whole thing needs to focus right now on getting itself back on a track with four wheels on the car, no matter what the car is, and starting racing again. And then, you know, reassess the situation once that can happen, once the money starts to trickle back in again, because it won't be the money we talked about before. You know, talking about $25 million roughly as a fee from a racetrack. I'm pretty sure that this whole thing will have caused enough grief to everybody for that $25 million not even to be want to be thought about for the future. Every government in the world is spending huge amounts of money to get their country to survive and their people to survive. They're not going to want those luxuries at a huge high-end expenditure. So, you know, the future isn't going to be what the past was. It's going to be a lot different. And I think you just got to stabilize it right now and say, okay, let's get this thing together. What could we do to the cars now? If Ferrari reckon the cars that were proposed for 2021 or 2022, if they're cheaper to run, then you look at what you've got now and say, right, what can we do to these cars during this interlude? What can we do with these cars to actually make them cheaper to run as well? Is it shorter races? Is it, you know, is it two-day weekends? Is it one-day weekends? Just to get the thing kick-started again and get it back on track.
Absolutely. And Zak Brown, a few days ago in an interview with BBC, talked about the fact that, you know, four teams could go out of business because of this. And while some people think that's alarmist, it's not, is it? Because there are only 10 teams that make up Formula One. That's really what Liberty owns, the 10 teams capable of putting cars on track. And actually, a small number of those teams can only do that because of their technical partnerships with others. Haas, for example, fully independent, aren't set up. They'd have to spend more money to be able to do it. So, you know, without those 10 teams, Liberty doesn't really have anything. It doesn't. That's what it owns the commercial rights to, really. So that's the number one priority for them, has to be to protect those teams.
Yeah, and I think when Zak Brown says four teams could go out of business, I think he might just be underestimating a little bit, you know. There's deep pockets in Formula One, but they're only so deep. You know, Red Bull, for example, you know, whenever you can't go to a bar and you can't go out and buy your red can of Red Bull in a, you know, a shop or in a bar, what's happening? You know, this is worldwide. This is not just one little country that's suffering the consequences of a bit of a shutdown here and there. This is worldwide. So, you know, Red Bull's income right now must have dramatically fallen. Mercedes car sales, Renault's car sales, you know, Ferrari isn't open. They're not making cars. It's a big hit for all of these people. So let's not underestimate the problem. The small teams might be the ones that can actually survive because they can, you know, sort of shut up shop and reduce the cost dramatically. But the big teams, the costs are so high, they're the ones that you might just see disappear out the window very, very quickly.
Yeah, having a smaller cost base at this time is a positive. Well, yeah, complicated situation. So thanks very much, Gary, for your insight into it. Hopefully we will get to a point where the correct action is taken. But obviously it's a very as usual, a very three-dimensional challenge, isn't it? With not just technical. So let's hope things are sorted out. Obviously, we'll be back next week with another episode of the Gary Anderson F1 Show. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. There's loads of material on there, including some excellent work from Gary Anderson himself. And do check out our other podcast, the Race F1 Podcast. We've got an eSport podcast, Formula E, MotoGP, and of course, Bring Back V10s, the classic F1 stories podcast. And also check out our YouTube channel. We'll be back next week with more from Gary.